Welcome back to Tasteland. I am Francis Sear.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto.
And today we're going to be talking to Greta Rainbow. Daisy, who is Greta?
Greta is a writer, researcher, and fact checker who has contributed to Dirt and Beyond Dirt. She had two excellent pieces in Los Angeles Review of Books in the past 12 months. At least one of them has already come up on this podcast. Mm-hmm. We talked about her piece for Dirt last year about Honor Levy's My First Book being voted basically the funniest Dirt piece of 2024. I was trying to remember how I met Greta. We'll have to ask her when she comes on. According to my recollection, I met her when she came to a party that I was throwing with somebody else we had not met before. And she was like, hi, kind of like, I'm at your party. And I was like, yes, you are. But we'll see if she remembers it that way.
That's a great meet cute.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling me that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
One thing I want to talk about briefly before she arrives here, this has already been discussed in plenty journalists' newsletters and tweets. But GQ last week publishing the Lindy Man authored piece and then the Cold Healing piece the next day. Both of these people are independent newsletter writers, mainly known for their tweets. And clearly we noticed, we talked about it.
Yeah. I mean, everyone who has like any sort of sense of editorial strategy noticed. It was like, choose a pattern. I see what's happening here.
Choose a pattern. It's been 1 week, though none since. A pattern I drew from it too. Was that obviously, you know, in December, Eater, Vox, I forget which, it's like a, you know, nesting dolls of companies, but basically Eater, Brillis laid off a bunch of people. Eater is rolling up their city verticals into regional verticals, leaner operation, et cetera. They fired Robert Sietsema, who is an amazing food critic, one of the main reasons I read Eater New York. So they fired him. And then one thing I noticed is a couple weeks later, there's this Instagram account called Food Baby NY, run by this guy, Mike Chow. I looked up his LinkedIn, actually. He's a former, like, Goldman, former, I don't know, maybe still current, VP at Goldman, I think, or JP Morgan, one of the two, for the past 20 years, according to his LinkedIn.
Work in finance to be a food influencer.
To be a food influencer. Because you have to buy all that food. Anyways, yeah. Long story short.
God forbid it was somebody working class or with a background in the service industry.
Eater had written about him twice. One is like, you know, who is this creator? What does it mean to be a food creator? And then again, like a couple of years ago with the rise of TikTok. But a week or two ago, they published a listicle, like what Mike Chow from Food Baby NY says are the best slices of cake in New York, something like that. That was the first time they'd ever published him, that he had a byline there. So I thought that was not a coincidence that came shortly after those layoffs and seemed of a piece with the GQ editorial strategy, no?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think it's just part of this trend of like actors interviewing actors.
Beyonce writing her own interview or whatever for Rolling Stone, whatever that was.
Yeah. Somebody suggested, do you watch the show Traitors?
Of course.
Okay. Well,
I'm caught up.
Helen Holmes, my friend Helen Holmes has sort of been dog fooding it to me, but I was actually going to watch and then Dorinda, whatever. I was only going to watch for Dorinda, but
it was a pity that Dorinda went out so early. Spoiler alert. Sorry.
I'm just like, if you were going to manipulate the show to be more interesting, which it already is, it's reality TV. Why would you let her?
Well, there's kind of a, in these first few episodes, I'm saying too much, but there's a bit of an anti-housewife agenda, which, you know, loaded, I would say.
Very loaded. Well, long story short, somebody suggested a show like Traitors, but for posters. Mm-hmm. And I think every once in a while, this strategy sort of surfaces in different media cycles. And it's just Twitter. But if you like look at everything as the reinvention of magazines, like this is similar to when celebrities got to be on the cover instead of models. Obviously, there's like a rebellion and then some people professionalize, or it just goes back to what it always is, which, you know, if the readership goes for it, great. If they don't.
Yeah. I wonder if they did, because my guess there is like that it's like a margins decision where it's cheaper to pay an influencer who then will, you know, post it to their 400 some thousand Instagram followers than it is to pay a full-time senior food critic salary, right? Like specifically with the Eater situation.
Sure, yeah, in the short term, but in the long term, if you're a food magazine, you need a food critic.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of when you did Critics Spotlight a couple weeks ago and you used your primordial soup metaphor.
Oh, I don't even remember. I was crazy back then.
You were deep in the soup, still deep in the soup. Maybe your head's above water level, soup level now. But I don't know if you read the Critics Spotlight from last week with Lindsay Stanberry, who's the creator of this newsletter, The Purse, formerly founding editor of Money Diaries, but mm-hmm. she, unrelated, unprompted.
Genius. Thank you for your contributions to the culture.
Well, I asked her, like, you know, are you a creator, writer, journalist, whatever? Mm-hmm. And she said, I don't really know, blah, blah, blah. It's a murky stew. So I'm loving these food metaphors. Anyways, Greta is here. Let's chat.
Get in here.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you guys?
Doing good. How are you?
Oh, we're so good.
Good.
Welcome to the pod. Welcome to Tasteland, Greta.
Thanks so much for having me.
Greta, I was trying to tell Francis how we met, and my recollection was that we met when you came to a party that I was throwing with somebody else. But I don't know if that's true.
No, that's definitely true. And when I was, you know, thinking about the internet and what it's good for, I was like, it's for making friends. Like, that's mm-hmm. how Daisy and I met. Yeah, that was a weird time. I want to say it was summer 2021.
Yeah.
That sounds right to me.
Wait, you say the internet is making... Do you have a lot of friends you've made on the internet these days, currently, at the moment?
I think so. And even just, like, people who I've gotten... I've been getting better at, if I see someone in the real world, mm-hmm. that I'm like, I know that we follow each other on Twitter. I know I'm reading your pieces, and to acknowledge that instead of being scared of them. Mm-hmm.
But Greta, who did you come with? Who brought you?
I came alone.
Wow.
But how did you know about the party?
You definitely invited me.
Oh. Was that the time? I there was one summer where one of the invitations, I made it look like a purple PR press release. Mm. And for like an art opening, but it was like too realistic. Some people thought it was real.
Mm. And so they were like, thanks so much for, but I have to decline.
So we were internet friends already.
Yeah. We were internet friends, but not even that close. And so I was very like flattered, and I remember distinctly not wanting to bring anyone. Because I was like,
you want to be yourself.
I want to be myself. I felt like
explore a new possibility of you.
Yeah, a new, like, you know, coming out of the pandemic, like, media girl.
Had you already fact-checked one of my pieces by then? Because Greta, Francis, I neglected to mention, Greta has talked to my mom multiple times.
Oh,
fact-checked.
For facts.
Things that I've written, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, she's in the contacts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we should talk for a little while about your Glance Back piece in the LA Review of Books, mm-hmm. Which is the ostensibly the reason we had you on. Tell for the audience, what is Glance Back and why did you write about it?
Yeah, so Glance Back is a really cool, it's a browser extension, is what it literally is, but it's also, it's a piece of net art, it's durational art, and was coded in 2018 by the artist Maya Mann, who is, she's doing all kinds of different things. But this is my favorite piece of hers, I think, because it's really simple. And the idea is that at a random time every day that you have, you know, Chrome open, when you open a new tab to, like, you know, make a new search, then your webcam will open and it'll take a surprise photo of you with the prompt, what are you thinking about? And then you kind of have to respond to that prompt, and then it logs that capture into this archive that's saved, stored locally, so only to your computer. And so it's a really lovely, like, the way Maya describes it is great, about it being this relationship with your computer, and you're spending all this time together, and it's always looking at you, and this is a way to look back at it. And so I've been using it since November 2023. I think after I met Mayan person and was like, this would be kind of a fun, interesting thing to do. And then it did become this ritual that I can't imagine getting rid of.
You're still doing it.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Did you like start it thinking like, oh, I'm going to write about this? Or you're just like, this is cool, I'm going to do this?
It started with this is cool, but definitely anytime I need to honestly get out of this of like watching a movie, going to an art show and being like, well, maybe I'll write about this. I guess that's how we just work.
That's kind of the thing.
Writers are always writing, you know?
Writers are always writing.
Famously. The last, maybe, you know, spoiler alert, if you haven't read this piece yet, but the last sentences are, my time lapse is documentation of a working woman slowly aging, an accumulation in lockstep with decay, and my screen is a grave marker. I'm getting better at writing here. I'm deepening my frown lines here. I don't know, reading that, it made me think of like the, I guess more sinister because in the way that it is like cloud-based, but you know, the photos, I imagine we're all three here iPhone users, but like the photos your iPhone will like serve you when you accidentally scroll like to the left, and it's like in review, and somehow it's always like the five or six same photos, but I like caught myself going down the rabbit hole of like looking at those and then like going in and scrolling back to like 2018. I was looking for what did I look like, not what was I doing, but like what did I look like 7 years ago, you know? I don't know. I like that, like this is a like it's a locally stored thing. Because the other thing, I like randomly on Twitter last night as I was preparing for this, I saw this tweet by this woman, Ashley Jovik, I think is her name. It's a Norwegian O thing in there. But she was this Apple employee who was fired as retaliation against some whistleblowing. And then it related to this, the context I saw it in was like, she had I'm going to get some of the details wrong. There's some lawsuits, OSHA involved. And she had sued them for like some photos that were like evidence in their lawsuit against her or whatever. And one of them was like a nude she'd taken and sent to somebody she was dating on her phone. But like then reading into it, there's this whole thing where like Apple is this company that's very pro privacy, right? And like them introducing like ad pixel blocking stuff a couple of years ago. But for employees, it's so not private. Like they're encouraged to use their personal device and like connect their personal Apple ID to their company work. And like, you know, there's this app called Gobbler that they rolled out when they were testing Face ID stuff. And it would just take a picture of them at any given time, whenever they open their iPad or their iPhone. And then they can't delete that ever. Like that's all Apple's property. And so I was thinking about that, how this is, that's kind of the Wario of the Glance Back project.
That is terrifying. And I feel like that's, yeah, exactly the way to describe it, this evil, like your image not belonging to you versus this sort of quaint, like, I want to share it with my laptop. I feel weird talking about, I talk about that too, of like, why am I talking about my laptop?
Your
like
relationship it's sort of with your
sentient.
Laptop.
Yeah. Like, I'm not stupid. I know it's not, but I do feel very attached to it. I take my laptop everywhere. I am that have laptop will travel. Like,
put out your shingle.
Like, I love going to a cafe and working for hours. And I feel like maybe with work from home, like that is less romanticized. Not that we need to romanticize it, but I still, yeah, have that feeling. And so want to kind of have that relationship and not have it be about, you know, Apple stealing my image.
Yeah, on one side you have total surveillance, and on the other side you have total self-knowledge. So when you say it's stored locally, does that mean like if you got a new laptop, you would lose it? Or is it in your iCloud?
It is. If I got a new laptop, I would lose it because of where it's stored right now on just like my downloads. Mm-hmm. But I think that I could just transfer that folder over to iCloud.
I actually stood out to me when I read this because of I have seen arguments about local storage being better for privacy. Mm-hmm. People mm-hmm. basically saying, like, we've all just accepted that, you know, if you want to use an app or a program or a game or something, you have to give up all this data. But, like, you know, every program used to be run locally on every device. And then the paradigm shifted. Now everything's in the cloud. And it's like, well, clearly from a privacy perspective, having the option to run programs locally or play, use an app locally that we now have to just automatically opt in to being part of the data pool would be great. But then you see stuff like the things that have been lost in the cultural artifacts that have been lost in the LA fires, and you realize that the risk mm-hmm. of local storage is one point of destruction. And I think, Greta, one of the pieces that you fact-checked for me was like one of the pieces where I was talking about storage, or a couple of pieces where I talked about storage as explaining so much of contemporary life. And, you know, it was the book that I am always threatening
Your
to write.
Your book.
But
oh, please do it.
I mean, but I don't talk about it in the sense of like, oh, I could have written that book. Like, I very much at one point chose not to pursue it, to run dirt. But I obviously notice everything that feels like it supports this thesis. And it's horrible to hear, like, oh, Gary Indiana's archive had just mm-hmm. arrived in Pasadena. And that's not a digital archive. So that was, you know, physical things have a single point of loss or single point of failure and always have. But I think what I liked about Maxwell Neely Cohen's big interactive essay about storage recently was like just the acknowledgement that a lot of digital things have a single point of loss as well, or far fewer, you know, backups than most people assume.
Well, in the context, next episode, we're going to be interviewing Mike Pepe, and I've been reading his new book, Against Platforms, and he makes this point, like, that the original purpose of the internet is so, like, information could survive in the case of nuclear war, because it would be this, like, noded system where it's that nothing is stored in one place. It's like things are stored in separate places simultaneously. So I'm thinking about that. I want to linger on with the Glance Back app is MacBook Apple Photo Booth, which you reference in the piece. And I opened at the coffee shop this morning for the first time in probably 7 years. I did not take a picture. I probably should have, but I was kind of like taken aback at how high quality it was, because I think the last time I took a photo booth photo was probably 2016 or 17. On a 2012 MacBook. Have either of you used Photo Booth like in any time in the past decade?
I use it every time right before we start the podcast to check my makeup.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I used it 45 like... minutes ago. I didn't take a picture, I just looked into it.
Yeah, Francis, I cannot believe that you're not taking regular bedroom photo booth selfies.
The laptop doesn't go in the bedroom.
What?
Is that a strict rule? What?
Not even a strict rule. I've never, like, you know, when I was when in my younger years, laptop in the bedroom all the time. But I think, like, that we work from home and I'll be working. I could be working any given hour. You know, maybe I'll take a long break for dinner early and then I'll be working at, like, 8 p.m., 9 p.m. But, like, the laptop stays here in the desk. I feel like I already have so little work, private life separation. Yeah, I can't remember the last time. Last time I used my laptop,
very strange creature,
in my bed was probably, it's been probably half a decade.
What the heck?
That is incredible restraint.
It's not even restraint. It's just like, so when you were talking about like your relationship between your laptop and how it's this like special thing, I was thinking about like how that used to be true for me before the laptop became a work tool for me, like in college and then for a few years after college when I was working in like kitchens and coffee shops, the laptop was purely like a recreation tool, right? Like I was like looking up music, reading new music blogs. I was obsessed with that, reading articles, reading Creative Independent, whatever, like such things. And then once I got a full-time laptop job for the first time, where the laptop was a company computer, I would say that relationship was severed. And then my personal relationship probably shifted more to my phone than the computer. Mm.
Which I assume you do use in bed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right about that.
That's right.
When I was in, I think it was seventh grade, I asked for Christmas. I had like a long list of possible things that I could be given. Mm-hmm. Like cell phone was one of them. I think I got a phone like the next year.
Ninth grade for me.
Phone, like, you know, and we're better for that. But phone, like a DS, like,
oh yeah,
like a ton of things. All
sixth grade for me.
Technology based. Sorry. And never got one of those. My sister did. And then my parents chose to get me this Dell laptop. Mm. And I got it and I cried, which I'm making myself sound like this horrible child. But I was just like, oh, this is not, it wasn't tears of happiness. It was like, this is not this pretty, shiny Apple product that I asked for.
Yeah.
And they were like, but it can do so much more than that. Like you're asking for all these different things that will achieve like different ends, and this can do everything. And I just remember being like, it's like this clunky black thing I don't want. Mm-hmm. And they didn't understand. And then of course, yeah, I had so much fun on that laptop. But it was a different kind of like, it wasn't this fetishized object.
I had that same experience with getting a phone when, like, in ninth grade when I got a phone. That would have been the latter half of 2009 or 2008. Regardless, it was like, it wasn't a Motorola Razr, but it was some, like, sliding Motorola that you could put MP3s on and listen to music. My parents were like, oh, you'll like this one because, like, you know, you like music. And it was that same feeling of, like, it wasn't the fetish object and like it wasn't an iPhone. It wasn't as cool. And like I cringe so hard looking back on like how on like the feeling of disappointment and like
yes.
feeling let down, which it faded pretty quickly. But like on receiving and opening it, I'm like, well, this is cool, but this is like this isn't the point. Like, I don't know. It's pathetic. I was also so last thing about the relationship to the computer that I was thinking about was like when it shifts from like desktop like computer room thing to the laptop. Like I think the first time I used a computer was in kindergarten. So like 1999, 2000 or so, whenever that was. There was that. And then there was the next one. We like moved houses and we were there for the rest of my childhood. And we had the computer room there. And then there was like in eighth grade, my equivalent of like getting the laptop. I was a gamer then. So I got my parents' deal with me. They were like, if you work this summer, we'll pay for half of a computer. And so I got like, then I had it in my room, like set up in my closet. And then it was like really the personal relationship. Like this is embarrassing, but there was one time where like I've gotten some fight with my sister and they, to punish me, they took the keyboard away. And I was like, so like it, I remember feeling so like, aghast. Like that was like part of me. Like I spent, you know, every second I was home from school and not doing homework on the computer. Anyways, yeah, we'll stop there.
Our family computer was like in the living room so that my parents could like monitor our usage. And I remember like I saw this picture on Twitter the other day of like this woman, I don't know, being like, why does my son have like a spoon taped to the side of his computer? It's because like with the convex back, you could see your parents coming from any direction.
Did you do
that? I feel like I could just tell any noise in the house if it was the beginning of an approach. Not that I was doing anything crazy on there. And I will say, like, I never got really into trouble online. So I think my mom maybe, like, has been vindicated. But there is definitely a surveillance aspect of our desktop placement.
Mm. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, the computer room is definitely, like, this memory. I remember, yeah, like, going into other kids' houses, watching, like, Weird Al YouTube videos. And then I spent a ton of time on my laptop, like really late at night in high school on Tumblr. And I do think about, sort of like what that did to my brain and how that was, there was just this, like this total influx of content that, how do you even monitor that as a parent? Like, it's so kind of like temporal and amorphous. And I wouldn't like, I don't regret anything. It definitely, that made me who I am, was being on there, but it was a lot. Were you guys Tumblr kids?
Sort of. I wasn't on Tumblr until I was in college, which is around the time that I would have also been reading stuff like Thought Catalog, and it that opened up a whole other world to me, because I'm sure I came in to read more of the like BuzzFeedy stuff, but then that's how I found out about like Alt-Lit. And I remember Sam Hine, who is, you know, we know Sam Hine at GQ now. I met Sam Hine on the internet. I had this college blog, which was it was an InterNESCAC blog. Sam went to a different college from me, and he took over the blog when I graduated. But I went to visit him one time, and in his dorm room, he had these Taolin stickers that were like, they were something like End the War on America by Bath Salts, or hold on, I have to look this up.
Was it in like that shiny Taipei Taolin?
I support material? The War on America by Bath Salts. And Sam had these like stickers like on his dorm room, and I was like, oh, you know about Taolin? Anyway, like long story short, I associate those two eras together, and I'm curious, like, while I was preparing for the podcast and reading the stuff, and I reread the piece that you wrote for us about Honor Levy's My First Book, where you talk about the difference between, or the sort of like spectrum between earnestness and irony. Like what do you think is going to happen to Alt-Lit as the internet kind of becomes worse and worse? These platforms are degrading. We should have said this up top, but like our loose theme for this episode was like, is the internet bad now? Can it be good again? I feel like a lot of the stuff that we're talking about is nostalgia for things that felt, seem better in retrospect. Maybe they didn't feel as good at the time as we remember. But I wanted to ask, like, whether the fate of Alt-Lit is actually tied to the internet, or is that just an illusion?
Hard question. And I love the idea of it not being tied to the internet, and that is sort of the tunnel out. Because the worst Alt-Lit is the stuff that sounds like someone trying to replicate early Taolin. And it has this feeling of plugging into ChatGPT, like, please scan Shoplifting from American Apparel and now write me a passage about like waiting for my girlfriend to show up at Clandestino and being sad. And like, and so I think there's something about AI and going on the internet and reading so much AI. For me, that's like a big, when I think about the internet being bad now, I think about Googling something and being hit with that AI response up top. And so I'm wondering if writing that is inspired by the internet and derived from the internet, like how can it be interesting to read if it has the AI voice, which I do think there is like a weird distinct voice that's being created.
Well, going back though to the earnestness and irony thing, I actually pulled the quote. This is like the first line in your piece, a year review of Honor Levy's My First Book, where we get into like what is post Alt-Lit. Basically, one time really late at night, I tried to draw the definitive scale of irony versus earnestness in the notes app on my phone. Notes app being mentioned, very funny for reasons that will become clear shortly.
In the coming weeks.
But I'm like, if we take alt-lit to be the sort of like, or like parallel to irony is maybe like internet speak, right? Which basically sounds the same once replicated, which is why it's like, does everyone sound like Tao Lin, or is Tao Lin just the first to use internet speak? Mm-hmm. And then earnestness, maybe the parallel there is like MFA speak. Like to me, internet speak and MFA speak are sort of two sides of the same coin, because the result is everything sounds the same. Nobody really has a distinct voice. The conventions are very easy to predict. And when the conventions are predictable, that's when it starts to feel like more artificial.
Well, wait, let me jump in for a second. Thinking about Tao Lin, when I never read Shoplifting from American Apparel, but I read Taipei in like 2013 or 14, I remember, and told all my friends like, oh, you have to read this. Like, this is so good. Like, I haven't read anything that makes me like, has ever made me think about the internet in this way, or seen the internet externalized like in a book this way. And at that time, like, that was still so novel, right? Like, I'd been on Instagram for, that was the year I got on Instagram. I'd been on Facebook for a few years, obviously. I was on Twitter, but only as like a lurker. I couldn't figure out how to post. Like, the point being is like, it all still felt so new. And so articulating it was new and novel, and putting it in a book was novel. Whereas now it's like, it's all tired. Like we're stuck in like the big flat now, as I've heard said, like there's nothing new to tread there, right? Like maybe there's some new thing that's like somehow about the experience of like interacting with AI writing on the internet, but I don't even know if that would be, maybe there's an interesting way to write that in like a novel form, but I don't know. I think back then it was like, this was still also new. The internet was like, the social internet was like not even a decade old, really. Maybe it was a decade old, we could say. And now it's like 2 decades old, and it's accelerated, and it's TikTok, and TikTok's about to be banned. And I don't know. I think it's just like, it's become too rote.
So where do you see the opportunities for actual novelty? I mean, Greta, you're saying like the tunnel out is alt-lit that does not mimic the former distribution of the internet. Can such an alt-lit actually support people financially? Not that it was ever that lucrative to begin with.
Well, I wonder if another way out is not being so concerned about how the writing will be received by a really specific group of people. I think that like a lot of alt-lit was speaking to this like small incestuous community that was so fun to look into from, as we all did, like not from yet living in New York. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I remember going to see Tao Lin when he was on a book tour in Seattle, and like having to be, you know, dropped off at the bookstore. Like I was not yet at that point. And so it was fun to look in on, and it felt like this close community of people talking to each other. And earnestness for me is something about like getting out of the small circles of people who you want to impress or mimic, and start talking about things beyond ourselves, just like caring about the world more than our little, like the people we're talking to on Twitter. And so that could be exciting. And I think, yeah, maybe why not like be profitable in that way? But is alt-lit also, is it by definition about, you know, being othered from like a larger audience? I don't know.
With Daisy, wasn't it you who has been on record multiple times as being against scenes?
Yeah.
Am I correct?
I feel like
that's applicable here, right?
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think my most recent criticism of scenes is that they're shortcuts for attention. Mm-hmm. So if you are trying to figure out like if I'm an editor at a publishing house, a big five publishing house, and I feel like my job is to find the next hot young novelist, and I don't look outside of a group of 20 people that interact with each other online and go to the same parties because I'm a lazy piece of shit, and I consider that talent scouting, then like that's an example of using a scene as like, it's lazy. But for the people who are in the scene or adjacent to the scene, it also becomes like an creative inhibitor because people are more concerned with the social dynamics around it than they are actual cultural production. I think what I originally said in my piece against scenes is like when a group of people becomes more concerned with proximity to cultural production than the production itself. And the thing that is so infuriating for anyone inside is nobody ever feels like they're at the center. Like it's like the principle in physics where you can't actually observe certain types of like particles or whatever. Like as soon as you feel like you're getting the closest to the center, like it shifts again. Mm-hmm. I don't consider myself part of a scene, but it's very hard to like see ourselves for what we are. And like, I got drinks or dinner with my roommate recently at this like, always empty, never a wait, like never cool, has been there forever, Italian place near where we used to live in Clinton Hill. I was like, let's go for old time's sake. And she made a reservation. I was like, you're crazy for making a reservation. Remember, there's never anyone there.
It was packed.
No, there was nobody there. It was exactly as I remembered it. And anyway, so like decidedly unsceney restaurant. And she was like, well, she kept saying, you're so cool. Or like, you know, you're cool. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Uh-huh. Like we used to share a bathroom. I used to go into your bedroom and like steal your Q-tips when you were at work. We lived together when she wrote for The Cut and I was a freelancer. I had like barely any bylines, nothing that would impress anyone. And she's like, well, you're in the New York Times. And I was like, yeah, but like, what is this like your cool thing? Like, it's me, right? Like it was very eye-opening because I think like that is why so many seemingly successful people or people who seem to be at the center of a scene are so miserable. It's because nobody can see themselves for what they are. And their primary social experience becomes the envy of others or envying others. There was nothing about this interaction with my old roommate that felt like envy. We're like sisters. But that's, I don't know. It was funny.
So one thing I'm thinking about, the idea of a scene, like a labeled scene, because I think that's really relevant here. There was this book I read in my freshman year cultural anthropology class called Number Our Days, which is like the woman, Barbara Meyerhoff, I think she wrote it, published in 1980. She was this anthropologist who like, you know, done the anthropology thing, gone to cultures around the world, whatever. And she was trying to work on a project. And I think she was somewhere down in Mexico. And they were like, what are you doing? Like, go write about your own people. Like, why are you here? Go away. And she was like, oh, I should do that. So she's Jewish. She went to a retirement home in Venice Beach and did this book on them. And so the subtitle is A Triumph of Continuity and Culture Among Jewish Old People in an Urban Ghetto. It's a great book. But the reason I'm bringing it up is there's this one person, who's like protesting against her interviewing him and writing about him. And he says something like, I don't want you to write about me because it'll be like sticking a pin in me. And then like, then I won't be able to roll, right? Like you put the definition in something and it's like, it gets caught there, at least in the perception of other people. And he didn't want that. He wanted to be able to like roll on unperceived, which I think about a lot, like the idea of not wanting to have a pin stuck in you or sticking a pin in something like on purpose to stop it from rolling and get it caught there, right? And that's kind of what a scene is, like alt lit or something like that. Anything that's named begins collapsing in on itself because it's hard for a thing once named and defined to change if the impression associated with that initial naming becomes too widespread.
Number Our Days makes me think of that Annie Dillard quote that was in your Glance Back piece Greta. I don't know if you want to talk about that quote and why it stands out to you.
Oh, yeah, of course. The classic how we spend our days is how we spend our lives. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Have you guys encountered that like out in the world?
Yeah.
I've definitely. Yeah. Frequently. Like it's.
I remember so clearly. It used to be my friend Tori's Instagram bio. Oh, she probably doesn't even remember. I feel like I should text her now and be like, do you remember when that Annie Dillard quote was your Instagram bio?
It does have a bit of like a Rupi Kaur vibe to it. It's such an aphorism.
Oh, yeah. But it is lovely. Yeah. And I do like draw on it and think about it. I feel like I'll almost do it as sort of like a like bashing thing of if I've, you know, woken up and I've just been on my phone for an hour and I'm like, Greta, how we spend our days, how we spend our lives.
It's like an intellectual like bonk.
but then like reading more about, you know, the book that came from and her whole philosophy, and it's not supposed to be scolding. It's really supposed to be just thoughtful. And I was reading her at the same time that I was reading On the Calculation of Volume, which is this hot new septology. Well, only the first two. It is good.
Amazon's trying to sell it to me right now.
Mm-hmm. You guys can borrow my copy.
You'll like this.
You will. And it's a really... strange and slow and beautiful about a woman who is trapped in the 18th of November. And she's very alone in this. Like, and I describe it to people and everyone's like, okay, so Groundhog Day. And I'm like, yes, but no, but she's trapped in this day and she's alone in this. Like everyone else experiences a new 18th of November. While for her, it's been going on for over a year. It starts to take this turn where you're sort of trying to figure out the mystery of it. And you're like, is this sci-fi or it's speculative fiction ultimately. Mm-hmm. But, and then you realize like, oh, that's not what it's about. I'm not trying to figure it out. I am with the character trying to figure out like, how could I make the most of a day? And that ends up being really beautiful and yeah.
I did find your Goodreads and look at it.
Oh my
so
gosh.
I know that you also just read
for him.
Gary.
Berlin Atomize, speaking about privacy and Apple and such. No, well, I read your article last like a year ago or so about Goodreads and I was like, oh, she's got to have a public Goodreads. Anyways, I found it. Berlin Atomized. I've seen it. I've considered buying it. I'm asking you for an impromptu book review.
Okay, so I'm actually writing a review right now.
Okay.
So you can get the full thing soon. But
damn it.
Yeah.
This is really it's like and truly, yeah, everything. It is hard to not spin everything I consume into mm-hmm. a review. But also I feel lucky to be able to do that.
Yeah. I started tracking, I've never used Goodreads, but I started tracking like writing down all the books I've read in a note. 1 year ago. So I know I read 18 books last year and here's what they were. And only like two of them were fiction, et cetera, et cetera. But I've avoided Goodreads probably for like the exact same reason that I don't want another way to be known online. Right. There's enough ways. I don't want somebody to be able to look.
You don't want somebody to stick a pin in you.
Exactly.
Well, anyways. I can feel that way about like writing my crisis of language essay where I'm like, this happened. And then I finished it. And I was like, oh, I guess that's over now.
Your crisis over?
Yeah, I guess it's not ongoing because I wrote about it.
And it's good. So it's like, well, you're still good at writing.
Thank you.
Isn't that kind of famously one of the reasons to write?
What?
To process, to put a pin in something and move on?
No. One hopes.
One. Okay.
Did you something see The Brutalist, Greta?
I still haven't.
Okay.
Maybe I feel like I've seen everything else except for that.
Mm.
All right.
Maybe I'll go today. I am intimidated by the long run time, but I'm excited to see it.
Well, apparently the women's bathroom doesn't have an issue with a line,
right,
so
right.
Maybe.
Why is everyone tweeting about that?
No. Oh, just
because we live in a monoculture.
Oh, one more thing I want to ask about from the piece. You referenced this woman, Brooke Erin Duffy, and I clicked on it, the link, and looked her up, and she's this like social media creator scholar. And I'm glad that you mentioned her because now I want to buy her books. Can you say anything about her work?
Yeah, she is really cool and also like really nice. I think that I early into freelancing, I was finding all the different personalities of people who you reach out to for interviews. And she was really kind when I like was just getting into it. And she has kind of marries like feminist theory and thought with deep research and knowledge about technology and the internet. And I love her theory of the visibility bind, which is pretty simple. It's basically like, okay, you need to be seen. Yeah, you need to have a public Goodreads if you want people to ask you about your thoughts on books. Mm-hmm. But then that also opens up the possibility for people to criticize you and to say, yeah, you have horrible taste in books. Like, why are you acting like an authority? And she talks a bit more in the context of like female influencers and showing their faces. And then all these different ways that, you know, if you are racialized, like, you know, it's tenfold worse. But yeah, highly recommend her. And I will, I did want to go and answer Berlin Atomized a little bit, that I do recommend it. shout out to Julia, the author, another person who is cool on the internet and then genuinely very kind. And it's an interesting book.
Wait, what new theory, nobody is cool on the internet.
Nobody's, I like that.
Mm. Yeah, we can print t-shirts.
Well, we can argue about that.
But then they can be cool in real life. Mm. Or there's no cool.
I need to think about it some more.
I mean, when I was, you know, on the on the old desktop computer in my closet in high school, I thought a lot of people were very cool on the internet. But it's also because I was so isolated.
Name three.
Fuck, I don't know. It's probably all musicians, because that was like what I was obsessed with at the time. I will reveal myself here and say at the same time that I read Taipei, I was obsessed with Yung Lean, and similarly, you know, putting the good word out about him, I was like, this is so, it's so like such a product of like right now and the internet, and he's this like Swedish kid who's like doing rap because it's this like American export and he's exporting it back to us, and now it's so yeah, I thought Yung Lean was really cool. I still do, but I really thought he was cool when I was 19 years old.
I also thought he was really cool. And for Halloween one year in high school, my best friend and I were, I would have been, this is like kind of bad. We were Yung Lean hoes. Okay. And so we like wore,
you can say hoes on this podcast.
Okay, good.
Okay, well,
and it was just like wearing a bucket hat. And then
you had Arizona, like, that you poured some like vodka into. Mm-hmm.
And then t-shirts that we'd like embroidered something on related to his lyrics. And we were like supposed to go to his concert, but we were grounded or something. But yeah, big fans of him.
We never let you finish your thought about Berlin Atomized. Maybe the real Berlin Atomized is that we're never going to let you
atomized.
Say a full sentence about this book.
Should we end it? Should we end it right here? Should we really atomize?
That is performance art, and it does feel like the future of alt-lit.
This has been Tasteland. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
See you next week.